Christ is risen. I wasn't invited to speak because I'm a great musician or I'm not going to be lecturing on music theory. I'm what you might call a functional musical illiterate. I grew up singing. I was Protestant, so in our church we always sang congregationally. And back when I was a kid, we sang pretty much every day in school, so kids learned how to sing, unlike today, unfortunately. And so I can sing on key, I'm told. And the first time I entered an Orthodox church, there were many things that struck me, but the music was probably what touched me the most. And it wasn't just the melodies, because Protestants have some music that's not bad musically, but the words along with the singing really touched my heart. And it took me a while to overcome all the hang-ups that Protestants have about Orthodoxy, but that first encounter with Orthodoxy probably is the main reason why I eventually became Orthodox. And after I became Orthodox, I converted in Oklahoma in a parish that was mostly English-speaking, and then moved back to Houston where I grew up and was at St. Vladimir, which at that time was the only Iroquois parish in town. And for vigil, the first time I went there, there were some old Russian people who were holding down the fort, and it was as if when they saw me and my wife start coming to vigil more than once, they said, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." And after that, they actually stopped coming except on feast days. They were very elderly. And so it fell to me and my wife to sing our way through the vigil, which at that time we actually didn't have the tones memorized. So I had to memorize the tones. I had a recording, and so if it was tone 8 that week, I worked on tone 8 all week trying to memorize the tones. Sheet music is not much help to me. I know when the notes go up, I'm supposed to go up, and I know when the notes go down, I'm supposed to go down, but that's about it. So I can't sight read, but eventually learn my way to sing through a vigil. But I'm certainly not a great musician. But what I would like to talk about is, what does the Bible have to say about singing, about choirs? And it's not going to be an exhaustive survey, because as I started to dig into it, there's just so much that you could say about it. But I wanted to talk about some of the more important things that jumped out at me. But there's a story in the Old Testament which is probably my favorite story that most people don't know from the Bible. Most people, if they read the Bible entirely, they don't often read 1 and 2 Chronicles, although they're very interesting books. But at the very beginning of 1 Chronicles, you have these long lists of names. And when you see those kinds of things in the Bible, people's eyes tend to glaze over and they lose interest. But there's a lot of very interesting stuff in those books. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, there's a very interesting story that I think is an image of what worship and singing in particular is in the life of the church. To sort of set the stage, this was at the time of King Jehoshaphat, or Jehoshaphat. You might have heard the phrase "jumping Jehoshaphat," but that phrase actually has nothing to do with him, actually. It's sort of a way of saying a cuss word without saying a cuss word that sort of developed in English. But he reigned from about 873 B.C. to 849 in the kingdom of Judah. This was after the United Kingdom had been divided following the reign of King Solomon. And the northern kingdom was composed of 10 tribes, and it was by far the most prosperous. And Judah was the rump that was left to the line of David, and it consisted of two tribes, Judah, and then the very small tribe of Benjamin. And if you study just the geography, you can understand why Judah would not have been as prosperous as Israel, because there was a saying about the area of Galilee that it was easier to raise an orchard of olive trees in Galilee than it was to raise a single child in Judea. And that's because it's a mountainous area. It's not conducive to just bumper crops. Galilee is by far the place that you'd want to be in the land, which is why Christ did most of his ministry there. That was where most of the people were. That was sort of at the hub of international culture. People always went through Galilee when they were passing through. And Judah was up in the mountains, and the people sometimes were pious and sometimes not. Well, Jehoshaphat was one of the better kings. He was a very pious king. But he got word one day that the kingdoms of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, which probably refers to the Edomites, were ready to attack. And this combined force was far in excess of anything that they were prepared to be able to handle. And so Jehoshaphat went to the temple with all the people and he began to pray. And he ended that prayer by pointing out to God that we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon thee. And then we're told that a prophet stood up by the name of Jahaziel, who we're told is a Levite, a descendant of Asaph. And if you know your Psalter, you know that some of the Psalms were written by him. So he was a descendant of this psalmist, who was also one of the temple singers, and probably himself grew up singing with those temple singers. And we're told that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he said, "Hearken, ye all Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, and thou, King Jehoshaphat, thus saith the Lord unto you, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go ye down against them. Behold, they come up the cliff of Ziz, and ye shall find them at the end of the brook, before the wilderness of Jeruel. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, and see the salvation of the Lord with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Lord will be with you." And then we're told that at that time they began to praise God with a loud voice. And then early in the morning, as they went out to battle, we're told that King Jehoshaphat appointed that the singers would lead the army. So rather than the soldiers going out first, he sent the singers out first. And he said that they were to praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army and to say, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for his mercy endureth forever," which probably is sort of an abbreviated way of referring to the polyaleos. And when they began to sing and to praise, the Lord set ambushes against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, which were come against Judah, and they were smitten. For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, utterly to slay and destroy them. And when they made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, every one helped to destroy another. And when Judah came toward the watchtower in the wilderness, they looked unto the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies fallen to the earth, and none escaped. And what's interesting about that is as they began to sing the praises of the Lord, it was when God began to act. And we're told that after plundering for 3 days, because they said there was so much riches and armor and weapons that they weren't able to carry it all, so for 3 days they gathered up all the goods, and then on the fourth day we're told that they called the place the Valley of Blessing. And there they praised the name of the Lord, and they returned to Jerusalem and again worshiped God. And so before the battle, they worshiped and they sang. And during the battle, they worshiped and they sang. And then after the battle, they again went back to the temple and worshiped and sang. And the singers were leading the people in this spiritual battle before, during, and after. And the point is that when we align our hearts with the mind of God, when we see things the way God sees things, mountains move. That's when we are able to have the kind of faith to overcome whatever obstacles are in our way, and that's when the enemy is defeated. And there's something about singing that does that, or something about singing that opens up our heart, and the words that we sing communicate to our souls in a way that they don't in any other way. Now, in the scriptures, we're told about singing, and a number of points are made. One of them is that singing is to be led by those that have the skill to do it. In that story, what did King Jehoshaphat do? He found these singers and he had them lead the singing. He didn't just say, "Let's all have congregational singing," which is congregational singing is good, and we do that at certain points of the services, of course, but it's not unbiblical, it's not untraditional for the choir to be specially trained and able to sing things that maybe everyone isn't able to sing along with all the time. In 1 Chronicles chapter 15, it talks about how David was preparing to bring the Ark of the Covenant into the city of Jerusalem. This was before the temple had been built, but he wanted to bring the Ark of the Covenant properly and with proper ceremony. And so we're told that he spake to the Levites to appoint their brethren to be singers with instruments of music, psalteries, and harps and cymbals, sounding by the lifting up of the voice with joy. And then in that same chapter it says that Kenaniah, the leader of the Levites, was instructor in charge of music because he was skillful, it says. So they didn't just pick randomly somebody, and they didn't pick someone necessarily because he was the most pious. They picked him because he was the most skillful. He knew how to do it. In Psalm 32, we hear the word, "Rejoice in the Lord, O ye righteous, praise is meet for the upright. Give praise to the Lord with the harp, chant unto him with the 10-string psaltery. Sing unto him a new song, chant well unto him with jubilation." When it says chant well, that means sing well. And just as an aside, when you hear in the Psalter and when you hear references to these singers having also musical instruments, well, they did have musical instruments in the Old Testament, but what the fathers tell us about that is that that was a more carnal expression of the, but the more spiritual way that we sing on the psaltery is with the human voice. But they also interpret the musical instruments in other ways. For example, St. Augustine says that the 10-string psaltery that we're to play are the Ten Commandments. So in our life, we play that psaltery by living out God's commandments. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 40, we're told that all things are to be done with decency and in an order. And so that's why we have choir directors. That's why we have choirs practice. That's why we have people who are dedicated to spend so much time preparing the materials that we'll use in the services, because it's important. It's important that these things be done properly. It's important that these things be done beautifully. And in the Wisdom of Sirach, chapter 47, beginning with verse 8, there's a section that's speaking in praise of King David. But it says about him, "In all his works he praised the Holy One Most High with words of glory. With his whole heart he sung songs and loved him that made him. He set singers also before the altar that by their voices they might make sweet melody and daily sing praises in their songs. He beautified their feast and set in order the solemn times until the end that they might praise his holy name and that the temple might resound from morning." In Psalm chapter 25, verse 8, it says, "O Lord, I have loved the beauty of thy house and the place where thy glory dwelleth." Our worship is intended to be very beautiful. Compared with a typical Protestant service, our services in many ways are very extravagant. You can't have an Orthodox service and do it properly on a shoestring. Just to do it on the most basic level, there's a lot of things that you have to have. And even the smallest parish, which may be doing the liturgy in the most simple way, is constantly going to be striving to add to the beauty of their services and their worship, because it's important. It's an offering that we make to God. And it's also, it's a way that we show God how much we love him, but it's also a way that we raise up the hearts of all the people. And the way we sing is a big part of that. It's important that we sing in a way that raises people's minds to God and not in a way that distracts people. If you've been in a service where the singing is very bad, it can be very difficult to worship because you're constantly noticing how they're messing things up. And we want to make sure that we're not, I mean, if that's the best that a choir can do in a small community, then it's still something that God honors and that he accepts. But it shouldn't be something that we're complacent with. It's not something that we should be satisfied with when we can do better than that. And also, you have sometimes people who will complain about the Russian musical tradition in particular, because they'll say that it's very ornate, it's not like the pure Byzantine chant, which is so much more spiritual, which Byzantine chant is very beautiful. It's also very easy to do badly, whereas Russian music, I think, is much easier for a choir of limited skills to do well. But there's a story about Metropolitan Filaret which is very interesting. There was some occasion where I think the choir was singing some very elaborate piece, and some priest said to another priest, he said, "Why are they torturing the Metropolitan? Because it was very operatic piece. And the answer was he wrote it. So that ended that discussion. We're also told in the scriptures that singing should be done with understanding. And that means both that we should understand what we're singing, we should know how to sing properly, but it also means that our singing should be understood. In Psalm chapter 46, verses 6 through 7, we hear the words, and this is the Boston translation, which I prefer the Boston translation, but this is one spot where I think it's a little bit clunky. It says, "O chant unto our God, chant ye, chant unto our King, chant ye, for God is the King of all the earth, chant ye with understanding." Now, personally, in my parish, we replace chant with sing at that point. But sing with understanding. And then in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, this is in the context of St. Paul instructing the Corinthians about issues related to worship. In particular, in the church of Corinth, there were people who were standing up and speaking in unknown tongues during the service, and nobody understood what they were saying. And that's a whole other topic that we could give a whole other lecture on. But there's some principles that he talks about there that I think apply to our worship in a more general sense. He says in verse 15, "I will pray with the Spirit, and I will pray with the understanding also. I will sing with the Spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also." And then he says that in church, "I had rather speak five words with my understanding, that by my voice I might teach others also, than 10,000 words in an unknown tongue." Now, when I was introduced, it was mentioned that today is my wedding anniversary. Well, 28 years ago today, my wife and I were married in Chinese Baptist Church, because at that time I was not Orthodox. And so the Baptists in Houston have missions all over the city that do services in all kinds of different languages. And so the Orthodox are not the only community in the United States that have to deal with the issue of language. But one thing that these missions have discovered is that they do have a problem that's somewhat similar to ours, and that's that they have a first generation that understand the language that that community was formed around, but then the next generation doesn't quite understand it so well. And even though I've never been fluent in Chinese, when I was dating my wife, I taught the Sunday school there, and I was actually trying to teach some of these children some basic Chinese so that they could follow along in the services a little bit better than they were, because so many of them really didn't understand it. So this problem is a real problem that they have. It's also a problem that we have. Now, on the one hand, there are those in the United States that will say, well, everything should be done in English. This is America. Well, if the Baptists can have services in Russian, I don't think that there's any problem that we have services or churches that try to cater to people who are not English speakers. But I would also say that just like the Chinese Baptists start having to transition into English, we have to do that as well. And we don't want to leave behind the people who the language of their heart is Russian and Slavonic. On the other hand, if we don't transition into a language that their children can understand, we will lose them. And unfortunately, we've probably all seen that happen. If you've been in parishes that where all the services are all in another language, you see that when children reach a certain age, there's only a very small percentage of them that will keep coming, even though they grew up speaking that other language in the home. But they don't understand that language like their parents, and they're lost to the church in too many cases. Also, one thing that this doesn't mean, even though we want people to understand, sometimes there's a tendency to want to dumb things down. I've seen some really horrible translations that are in use, and the justification is, well, we want to make sure that people understand it. And sometimes people argue that we shouldn't use the sort of modified Elizabethan English that we use in our services. I don't think that is the problem that some people want to make it. In Israel, there were forms of Hebrew that ceased to be the current way that people spoke long after that time. They continued to use the Psalter. They didn't retranslate the Psalter into Aramaic and use that. They tried to teach people how to understand it better. And so I think that there's nothing wrong with trying to raise people up. There's nothing even wrong with trying to make sure that children in a parish that uses a lot of Slavonic learn to understand Slavonic. That's a good thing. But we want to make sure that it's within reach, but we want to raise them up. Among Protestants, there's been a tendency to want to dumb things down. If you look at the music that they use in so many Protestant churches today, the kind of singing they have is referred to by people who don't like it as 7-11 music. And that's seven words repeated 11 times. There's no real meat there. And that doesn't result in people becoming more pious. It doesn't result in people coming to know the Lord better. It's better that as people grow up and as they increase their understanding, that they're constantly discovering things that they didn't always understand, that they didn't understand so well when they were a child. And if you put it on the lowest level possible, the problem is that when people reach a certain level of understanding, they start thinking, well, this stuff is too childish, this is too simplistic, and they think that that's what Christianity is, and then they dismiss it when they really haven't properly understood it. The scriptures also tell us that music is to be instructive. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 16, St. Paul says, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." There's a very important homily that St. John Chrysostom gives on this passage. It's his ninth homily on Colossians, and if you have time, you can read it online. It's available in public domain. But he talks about in that homily that what St. Paul is saying is that we need to understand the scriptures, and if the word of Christ is dwelling in us richly, that means that we understand it well. And he makes an analogy, and he says, if you think of a rich man, when a rich man has a problem, is it really a problem? Like, to put it in modern terms, if a rich man's tire is flattened, is that a problem? If he gets a speeding ticket on the way home, it's a $150 ticket, is that a problem for him? No, because he's got lots of money to draw upon. And so any problem that comes his way, he's got the means to deal with it. Whereas if you're a poor man, when you have a tire that goes flat, that's a major crisis for you if you have a hard time affording expenses like that. If you get a speeding ticket on your way home or if you lose your job, you don't know what you're going to do. And what St. John Chrysostom is saying is that a person that's poor in their knowledge of Scripture is like that. When they're faced with a crisis in life, they don't know what to do. They don't have anything to draw upon. But if you're rich in the Scriptures, you never are going to face any kind of a crisis spiritually that you're not going to know how to deal with. But in particular, one of the ways that we get to know the Scriptures, one of the ways the Word of Christ dwells in us richly, is through psalms, hymns, and spiritual psalms. And I'll read a quote from this homily where St. John Chrysostom talks about this specifically. He says, "Teaching, he saith, and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual psalms. Mark also the considerateness of Paul, seeing that reading is toilsome, and its irksomeness great, he led them not to histories, but to psalms, that thou mightest at once delight thy soul with singing, and gently beguile thy labors. Hymns, he saith, and spiritual songs. But now your children will utter songs and dances of Satan, like cooks and caterers and magicians. No one knoweth any song. But it seems a thing to be ashamed of even, and a mockery and a joke. There is the treasury house of all these evils. For whatsoever soil the plant stands in, such is the fruit it bears. If it is sandy and salty soil, of like nature is its fruit. If in a sweet and rich one, it is again similar. So the matter of instruction is a sort of fountain. Teach him to sing those psalms which are so full of the love of wisdom, as at once concerning chastity, or rather before all, of not accompanying with the wicked, immediately with the very beginning of the book of the Psalms. For therefore also it was that the prophet began on this wise, blesses the man that hath not walked in the counsel of the ungodly. And again, I have not sat in the counsel of vanity. And again, in his sight a wicked doer is despised. But he honoreth those that fear the Lord, of companying with the good. And these subjects thou wilt find there in abundance, of restraining the belly, of restraining the hand, of refraining from excess, of not overreaching, that money is nothing, nor glory, and other things such like." Music is incredibly instructive. If you think about when you were a child, one of the first things that you learned when you were being taught to read was the ABCs, but you weren't just taught the alphabet, you were taught to sing it. And when you know the ABC song, you know the alphabet. And if you ever have had to alphabetize stuff, you'll catch yourself, if you're like me at least, sometimes singing a line from that just to remember the order of the letters. Whereas, you know, without that in your head, you would have a hard time remembering the exact order of the alphabet. When my children were little, and also when I was teaching Sunday school, one of the things I discovered was that if you were just reading to a child or if you were just speaking to a child, it was difficult for them to pay much attention to you. But if you read a rhyming Bible story, they would be rapt in their attention to what you were saying. And that's not quite singing, but there's a melody almost to the rhyme that catches them. They notice that the words are in a way that catches their attention. And also singing. When my children were little, we would try to sing as much as the prayers as possible, and we would keep them short when they were very little because we wanted them to grow up with that habit of doing their morning and evening prayers, and we wanted it to not be something that they thought was a painful thing to endure, but something that was a joy to experience. So it's a very effective way of instructing. And also, St. John of Shanghai has an essay that you can find online where he talks about how to keep the typikon. And in that essay, among a whole bunch of other things that he says that are interesting but not on the subject, he says that you should sing as much of the service as able unless you don't have people who are capable of doing it. Because he says that nothing touches the soul quite like singing it. And unfortunately, I know a lot of choirs, they'll sing maybe the first Tekirah and it praises, and then they read the rest of it. And it's, in some cases, because they have sheet music for that first Tekirah, and then they don't have sheet music for the rest of it. But if you sing the whole thing, it's so much more beautiful and more prayerful, and it's easier for people to really pay attention to what's being said. And again, these things sink into your memory. I could quote to you, unfortunately, as St. John Chrysostom was talking about, worldly songs that I learned in high school that I've not heard repeated since I was 18 years old. But I could quote some of those songs to you word for word because the fact that they were in a melody, they're in my head. In that case, not for the better. So we want to make sure that our children learn how to sing, and we want to make sure that they're singing the right things. Also, the scriptures tell us that singing enables us to receive the grace of the Holy Spirit. St. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, beginning with verse 18, "And be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord." It's somewhat similar to the previous passage, but here it's in conjunction with being filled with the Spirit. And St. John Chrysostom again says, "Dost thou wish to be cheerful? Dost thou wish to employ the day? I give thee spiritual drink. For drunkenness even cuts off the articulate sound of our tongue. It makes us lisp and stammer and distorts the eyes and the whole frame together. Learn to sing psalms, and thou shalt see the delightfulness of the employment. For they who sing psalms are filled with the Holy Spirit, as they who sing satanic songs are filled with an unclean spirit." And then further on down, he explains what it means to do so with your hearts unto the Lord. He says it means with close attention and understanding, for they who do not attend closely merely sing, uttering the words whilst their hearts is roaming elsewhere. So if we're singing and making melody with our hearts to the Lord, that means we're paying attention to what we're singing. In the life of the Grand Duchess Elizabeth, if you've ever read it, you've no doubt read about her martyrdom. And along with several other members of the royal family and her nun Barbara, who was the one nun who refused to be parted from her, even though she was given multiple opportunities to leave and to save her own life, they were taken out into the woods where there was a mine shaft, an abandoned mine shaft, and they were all thrown down into this mine shaft, and they threw down two hand grenades, and the hand grenades didn't kill the people down below, and they were out of hand grenades. This was sort of a typical Soviet enterprise here. So they didn't know what else to do. So they actually set a bonfire over the mouth of the mine shaft because they were hoping that the smoke would suffocate the people below. But one person who came along and observed all this and reported this to the White Army when they later retook this area for a while and they were able to recover the bodies, said that long after they had left, he could still hear them singing in the mine shaft below. And one of the things that this tells us is the power of our singing. And it's not just the music, obviously, it's the music along with the words. That's the crucial combination. But if we have that music in our heart and we're able to sing, I mean, they didn't have a hymn book down below when they got thrown down the mine shaft. So whatever they sang, they had to have it memorized. But they sang and it gave them strength. I was listening to a Protestant minister who was complaining about the 7-Eleven music that I mentioned, and he was an advocate of singing the old hymns, which very few Protestant churches use anymore. It's amazing to me, because for people who've been Protestant all this time, I think they just really haven't noticed all the changes. But for me, I left all that when I became Orthodox in 1990, and so I remember how things were back then, which we're not talking ancient history here, and I see that in the denomination that I was raised in, my mother couldn't find a church that still sang hymns the way that they used to, even though the Houston area has probably a dozen Nazarene churches all over town. But she couldn't find one that still sang the old hymns, which they're not Orthodox hymns, but at least there was some content to them. It wasn't just as David danced in Jehovah's Side, I will dance with all my might, and some of the other kind of nonsense that you hear in some of these praise and worship songs that they sing. But this Protestant minister pointed out, he said, you know, when the martyrs were being burned at the stake, they would sing hymns. And how are these people going to do? If they're ever faced with that, what are they going to do? As David danced with Jehovah's Sight, you're going to sing that while you're being burned at the stake? I don't think that that kind of nonsense, that kind of fluff, is going to carry someone through an experience like that. But the martyrs did sing when they were being martyred, and it gave them strength. And when you think about people, you know, the slaves, when they were working in the fields, what do? They would sing while they worked, because by singing, it was able to make their workload lighter. And again, it wasn't Orthodox hymns, but all the more is our hymnody powerful and able to get us through whatever difficulties we may face in our life. So our music is to be understood, it's to be instructive, it's to be done well, because it gives us the strength that we need and the hope that we need and the power, and it opens us up to the grace of the Holy Spirit, so that like the people of Judah, when they face this overwhelming foe, we will be able to look to God and to have the kind of faith that we need to allow Him to get us through those difficult times. Thank you.